presents First Years, a podcast for all but geared toward adult first-time readers of Harry Potter, who need a space to enjoy each book and have adult conversations about it. My name is Sarah, and I'm honored that you've allowed me on this journey with you. Crack open a butterbeer, grab a seat, and let's discuss. Today, we're talking about Mad-Eye Moody and the Tri-Wizard Tournament. Hey everyone, welcome to episode 33 of First Years. Today is a very special episode because we have Jesse and Casey joining us to talk about these two chapters with us today. I just wanted to let you guys know that the first 5.5 minutes or so of our podcast, I didn't realize that I was recording audio from the microphone that's in my AirPods and not my normal mic that you hear right now. Luckily, I caught it. So Jesse and Casey sound fine. It's just my audio that doesn't sound very great for the first 5 minutes or so. And then it switches over to the good audio quality you guys are used to. So my apologies, bear with me. And I hope you guys enjoy the episode today.
Welcome everybody to episode 33 of First Years. Today is a very special episode because I have two guests with me. Jesse is returning and I have Casey here. Hi guys.
Woohoo! Hi!
Hello, hello.
I'm so excited that you guys decided to join me for chapters 12 and 13.
They are some juicy chapters.
Yes. And they are. I really love Harry Potter. Harry Potter's always been our thing. Our anniversary is Harry Potter's birthday. So,
is it really? I don't think I knew that.
Yeah.
We got together in late July, but we didn't really know the date. So we said, hey, let's just pick Harry Potter Day and then that'll be our anniversary.
I love that. Yeah. And now there'll be no confusion. You guys will never forget it ever.
No. Right? Can't happen.
Yeah.
So there's a lot to talk about in these two chapters. And I thought our first big topic to talk about could be the Sorting Hat song. But before we dive into that, I have two silly questions for you guys. The first one is why aren't there like enchanted umbrellas, or like why isn't the staff just lined up with like drying charms as the students enter the entrance hall, and it's just the thing where the students get soaking wet in the rain and then they just have to stay that way?
That's grossly inconsiderate of the teachers.
Yeah. That is a very fascinating question, because there, it seems like there's so much magic can do, and then like the simplest things for convenience just don't seem to happen.
Well, that's what I was thinking. Like, I was wondering where the line is between like, because we see like you said, we see magic do like amazing things, but like the kids are also like lugging their backpacks around instead of having like a spell that makes the backpack lighter or like shrinks their books. Like, so where is the line between like where you can use magic to like help out your life and like where you can't?
I don't know, because I'm thinking like, oh, you know, there's some complex magic they don't know. And then my brain thinks, yeah, if only there was a simple swish and flick spell that made your trunk float and then you could just carry it in that way.
Right. Or like, why aren't like magical backpacks like already for sale in Diagon Alley?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we were also along the same lines of drying off the poor first years. We're wondering, how do they regulate like the temperature inside the castle? Is there a spell for that?
That's a really good question.
They're never like, oh, it was freezing cold inside on this beautiful snowy day.
Is it possible that muggles have us beat with thermometers?
Honestly, probably. Like, because I feel like they do like talk about like all the fireplaces, but like there's definitely like not fireplaces, like enough fireplaces to like make all the corridors warm.
Yeah.
I mean, I think Muggles definitely have wizards beat in like a few ways. I mean, like pens are one of those ways, I think.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
I don't want to deal with ink and quills.
Advanced magical society, but still writes like it's the 13th century.
Literally facts.
Yeah.
So my other silly question is, we see Nearly Headless Nick in the Great Hall, and it says, quote, pearly white and semi-transparent, Nick was dressed tonight in his usual doublet, but with a particularly large ruff, which served the dual purpose of looking extra festive and ensuring that his head didn't wobble too much on his partially severed neck. Can ghosts change clothes?
I was wondering that too. I have a few thoughts on that because there's so much about ghosts in chapter 12. And I was always under the impression that they just wore like whatever they died in, basically.
Right, that's what I would think.
And then there's also the question of like, if this may be a little much, but like if you die gruesomely, can you even come back as a ghost? Like, I know Nearly Headless Nick is nearly headless and there's Bloody Baron, but where's the line in that too?
That's true. And also, if you can change your clothes, like why is the Bloody Baron just like forever in like bloody clothes? Like, yeah. Wouldn't, if you had the option to change, wouldn't you want to?
I would think so. I mean, he can scare peeps. Maybe part of that is his appearance.
That's yeah. True. Maybe it's a way of determined. And he's like, well, if it keeps the poltergeist in check, I might as well just stay in the blood.
Stay state. In it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He has a reputation to upkeep.
And then they talk about a ghost council too, don't they?
Yeah, the Nearly Headless Nick says that there was a council about what to do with Peeves, and the Baron put
right. So I'm how does that work?
As to what happens in the Ghost Council.
If it's
who was elected to the Ghost Council?
Pass.
Like, do they have elections for the Ghost Council?
That'd be funny.
You have to have been dead for 3 centuries before you can move up the ranks.
Right.
See, you say silly questions, but we were honestly just stuck on the ghosts and we're like, man, this is only the first part of the 2 chapters.
Well, this is why you guys are perfect to have on this podcast, because then it's not a silly question. I'm glad you guys were thinking about all of this as well. All right. So I guess I won't say let's move on to our more serious question. So this is the first Sorting Hat song we really get to see since book one. And it's different from book one. And I thought it was really interesting. And I thought it would give us a lot to talk about. So what were your guys' like first impressions of it?
It helps the school feel a little more ancient and traditional. It feels like there's a history behind the school a lot more, which I think goes on to come in handy once we start learning about these different schools later in the chapter.
I also think with talking about the founders, it's very interesting because we got a decent deep dive into the founders in book 2 with the Chamber of Secrets, but mostly like the divisiveness of it. So it is interesting in the song to see that they were friends. They did have kind of the same, not values in the students, they valued different virtues, but I think it shows more unity than we really got in book 2, because in book 2, it just focuses on the split basically.
Yeah. And you guys know, I could talk about like the house divide forever. But I think it's really interesting that you say that because it's true. It does seem like all 4 of them were friends. So it's like, why did they get along? But then, you know, nowadays at Hogwarts, there's huge rivalries between all of the houses. So I think that's really interesting. And do we think it really just comes down to like what Slytherin did with the Chamber of Secrets? Is that?
I think it comes down to teenagers. Teenagers can be judgy and mean, and high school is hard.
I think it's also very easy to place the brunt of the blame for division on Slytherin. But I am sure that, you know, Gryffindor, Ravenclaw, and Hufflepuff are guilty of their own prejudices, their own preferences.
I mean, in the books, we only see Gryffindors primarily interact with other Gryffindors. And I feel it's that way with all of the houses. I think part of it comes from the fact that the tables in the Great Hall are all divided by houses. So it's not like people are interacting at meal times. They're only interacting in classes. And even in the classes, I feel they probably would be divided, even if it's like Hufflepuffs and Slytherins, or, you know, Gryffindor and Ravenclaw. I feel they still would divide up by the tables into those same houses. I think it's with anything else. If you're not interacting with one another, there's, you know, biases that go into that. And then it's really easy to blame other people for what you feel is wrong.
Right. No, I think that's such a good point. Because, like, we really only see, like, when there's, like, house unity, it's usually between, it's, like, all the, it's, like, Hufflepuff, Ravenclaw, and Gryffindor against Slytherin, specifically. But one of the things that also struck me here was, like, the concept of tradition. And so we have the Sorting Hat ceremony that, like, the Sorting Hat was created as a solution to be able to sort kids after the founders passed on. And it's still in place today. And you're right. Why today do we still have, you know, four tables in the Great Hall where you're constantly dividing students? You know, where does sort of the importance of tradition or the respect of tradition come in versus, like, maybe doing things that are probably better in the long run for students and getting along with each other?
I think it's because people have a lot of pride in that tradition. Hey, we've done it this way for hundreds of years. And since the very beginning, we were always playing favorites with the students and saying which ones we thought were the best. And it's hard to let that tradition go. And even when it goes away to some extent, we all love to embrace that pride at the end of every year with the House Cup. And we embrace it at the Quidditch pitch every year. And everybody wants their team to be best.
Mm-hmm. So then do we think that, because we find out in these chapters, like, that the big secret that the Weasleys were keeping was the Triwizard Tournament is going to happen. So do we think we're going to see more unity between the houses because they can then come together for, like, pride of, like, Hogwarts instead of, like, pride for their house, or not?
I would think so. I mean, comparing it to sports in our world and competitions, even if you root for a different team than someone else, if a team that neither of you like is on, then you come together to root against that team that you want to lose.
For instance, like with basketball, you know, people are very passionate about, oh, it's the Lakers, or no, it's the Celtics or the Knicks. But when the Olympics come around and it's Team USA and all the all-stars go against Team China or Team whatever, then I think the national pride does bring more people together.
Yeah. No, yeah. So I definitely hope that we see that because, you know, given what we just talked about, I think there's a lot of dividing lines between students at Hogwarts. And I also thought it was interesting, like, the traits that the Sorting Hat lays out, that, like, for Gryffindor, bravery is prized. And, like, for Ravenclaw, like, being clever is the best. And, like, Hufflepuff, hardworking means you're more worthy. And Slytherin has power hungry matched with ambition. And I think that's, like, really interesting, where it's, like, with Gryffindors, it's, like, being brave because there's, like, a reward at the end. And, like, Ravenclaws are trying to be the best of the best. But, like, I don't know. I feel like being a hard worker, like, is important, but I also feel like working hard shouldn't be tied to like your worth.
Yeah.
You know? And I also feel like ambition comes in different forms than just like being hungry for power. But at the same time, I think the only examples we get of ambitious Slytherins are the ones that want power, really.
Which is weird, considering that I think the most ambitious student at Hogwarts is Hermione, who would never be a Slytherin.
Right.
Well, I think Slytherin is largely the loudly ambitious people. And I think it's interesting because I think a lot of the traits that are really amplified and desired from the founders can also be downfalls. They can also be flaws if they're taken too far, which I think we see a little bit of that. We see that in the ambition for Slytherins. And then even the other ones, like the, like you were saying, bravery for a reward, you know, it's sounds like it's more for the glory.
Mm-hmm.
And let's be real, Gryffindors can be a little pompous sometimes.
Yeah.
Percy Weasley pompous? How dare you? Never.
And hardworking, it's like one thing I've always been told with hardworking is like work smarter, not harder.
Mm-hmm.
Don't waste your time working super hard when there's an easier way to do it that can save you a ton of time.
Right.
And then Ravenclaws are just flawless.
Casey's saying that because she is one.
Yeah. I'm shaking my head.
Yeah, and like I think especially with Hufflepuff, I like definitely thought of like, you know, the situation we're in today where like the we're working from home, the lines between work and like your personal life are starting to get blurred because there's not like a specific time to leave the office and people are starting to find that like putting in all these extra hours doesn't mean you're going to go anywhere, really. So I do think your point about working smarter, not harder is a really good point to make.
Absolutely. Yeah. What would Hogwarts from home look like?
Oh God.
They'd have to lift the ban on underage magic for starters.
Oh, 100%.
Weasley twins wouldn't get anything done.
I wonder if they would have to like teach everything in the Great Hall. Because that might be the only space where you can like socially distance properly.
Boy.
I would hope with magic they could just cure it much faster than we muggles could.
This is true.
The cure is
call
probably
in Madame Pomfrey.
The cure is probably like some chicken egg hatched under a dragon, boiled in a cauldron of polyjuice.
Right.
There, that's the cure.
I know, seriously. Okay, so going back to House Unity, and we find out that the Triwizard Tournament is happening. So we find out that Durmstrang and Beauxbatons are going to arrive in October, and three students, one from each house, are going to participate in the Triwizard Tournament. But Dumbledore kind of casually remarks that the Triwizard Tournament hasn't happened in a while because they canceled it because so many people die. So, I mean, what do we think is in store for our champions then? And also, why wasn't the age limit in place beforehand? Like,
because I'm picturing some first year getting chosen hundreds of years ago and dying very quickly.
Right. Like, how is that fair to like have like the younger, like a first or second year, like go against like a seventh year that like clearly knows what they're doing?
I feel even without the age restriction that a first or a second year just wouldn't be chosen though.
That's true.
I feel they wouldn't be the best candidate because they know so little. They're very inexperienced to where, yeah, maybe someone under 17 could compete at a higher level. Someone like Hermione, who's very advanced, who works on stuff outside of school. But I don't think a little first or second year would even get chosen.
Yeah, that's true.
I'd love to see. I'd love to see this new Dennis Creevy kid get chosen. Just he might set the record for fastest champion ever.
So I went a little deep divey on the giant squids because it fascinates me when he comes and says he was the what is it exactly? He was pushed. Dennis says he was pushed back in the boat by the giant squid. So of course I did some research and was just fascinated by these giant squids, which for one, is it even a giant squid? Do we know it's a giant squid? Is the giant squid gonna come up again? And then there is only one clip that I could find, and it's like a very small clip of a giant squid in its actual habitat. And we didn't see that until 2012. Most of what we know from them comes from carcasses that have washed up on shore. And the first time a live one was ever seen was 2006. Their eyes are a foot in diameter.
Oh God.
They are cannibals. Like they eat all sorts of fish, but also like pieces of other giant squids have been found in the carcasses that wash up on shore. They really only have one predator that we know of, which is the sperm whale, which is how we know how big some of them can get, because we have found so few of them, but we find the beaks of giant squids in the bellies of sperm whales. And based on the beak size, they can potentially grow up to 66 feet, although the largest found on record was 43 feet.
Holy.
I love how passionate you got about researching the squid.
I love that though. Like, I am so glad you looked into that.
Yeah. So I'm really hoping the giant squid comes up again.
Seriously. So. And like, do we think though that like, do we think it's a regular giant squid or do we think it's like a sort of magical giant squid?
Oh, this is a magical world. It's a magic.
A magical giant squid, but I also feel normal giant squids are pretty magical at this point. I feel it's very likely Hagrid, you know, with his obsession with giant creatures, maybe brought the giant squid to the lake, bred
it. Would not be surprised. Just
little tiny.
But we see this in Harry Potter, where like little seeds are planted all across the book, sometimes in the very beginning, and the payoff doesn't show up for a long time later. Like last book you had the werewolf essay from Snape and it ended up being huge with Lupin's identity. Mm-hmm. So if this squid does show up down the road, it'll probably be quite the spectacle.
Definitely. And like, so we know the Slytherin common room is underwater. Like, does this, like, is that how we know it's a squid? Does it like sort of swim by the windows of the common room? Because that sounds terrifying. Like, I don't want to be in Slytherin if that's what happens on a daily basis.
Yeah, it's like a diameter. The eye is a diameter of a foot just staring at you through the common room.
Oh my window. God.
I don't want to see that.
That sounds horrifying. That sounds horrifying. And actually,
fall asleep in the chair and it's just there staring at you.
Right? And like, actually speaking of Hagrid, because I think that might be my new headcanon, is that Hagrid's responsible for the giant squid being in the lake. We meet the blast-ended Scroots in these chapters as well. And my question is like, where the hell did Hagrid get them from? Like, who gave them to Hagrid without instructions as to like what they feed on? Like, or did he just like stumble upon them in the forest? Like, I don't understand how he has like all of these magical creatures and he's like, oh, I don't really know what they eat. Where did you get them?
Yeah. Well, he has, what was the starting number? 100 of them?
Yeah.
Yeah.
He has like 100 of them. I don't think he would have found those in the forest. I think like, I almost imagine some like dark web, but for wizards.
Right? Like what is the wildlife trade of the wizarding world? I don't.
Right?
And then I bought him off the Tiger King in Nocturne Alley.
I mean, we know now how he got Norbert.
Right, but at least like that made sense. Like that had like a real plot like attachment. Like this, I'm just like, Hagrid, where did you get this?
I know. These are terrifying too.
Yeah. And also, I posed this question in a previous podcast, but I wanted your guys' opinion on it. Because Dragonhide is mentioned again in these chapters, where when they're in Herbology, they're wearing Dragonhide gloves. And Bill, when we met him, was wearing Dragonhide boots. But Charlie works on a dragon reserve. What do we think Charlie, how does Charlie feel about this situation? And also, like, what are the ethics of having Dragonhide products? Like, I understand they probably withstand a lot more stuff than like leather does, but like, I feel like dragons aren't really that common. Like, so what's like, who's making these Dragonhide products? And like, is Charlie okay with this?
My theory is that although dragons might be treated like cattle, they definitely are more rare than cattle. It is possible that dragons don't decompose much when they die. So if they're on Charlie's reserve until they die, and one massive dragon can make several hundred sets of Dragonhide gloves, dragon doesn't need it anymore.
That's true.
I think there probably is a lot of poaching of dragons, though, like we see of endangered species in our world, that could be very problematic. I think someone like Charlie probably wouldn't use something like that unless they need to. I think dragons have a lot of magical properties that would probably make you much safer in those than, say, trying to charm leather gloves or something.
Right.
Also, because I imagine if you did try to charm leather gloves, the charm might wear off over time. So you'd have to like charm it every time again before class. And poor little Neville would forget every time.
Oh, 100%.
Well, maybe Neville will be the Hogwarts champion. Oh no, he can't. The age line.
Oh yeah, the age
line. True. Yeah, that's a good point. I mean, like, because dragons are magical, it might be that they don't decompose. And you're right, I did think about how, since dragons are so big, you probably get like so many pairs of gloves off of one. But it's just interesting because like, it's never really touched on in what we've read so far. It's just like Bill sitting at the table wearing Dragonhide gloves. And then like two lines later, it's like, oh, Charlie, who works in a dragon reserve. And I'm like, wait.
Yeah.
There's no conversation about it at all.
It'd be funny, since we didn't see the beginning of that conversation. Maybe Bill and Charlie had just arrived home and they hadn't seen each other yet. And Charlie could have honestly been, what are you wearing?
Speaking of other magical creatures, so house elves sort of make an appearance again in this book. We met Winky at the Quidditch Cup. Dobby we met in book 2. And Hermione realizes during the feast that Hogwarts has house elves, and they're responsible for doing everything. Like, they provide the food, they make sure the common room is clean, which I think shows us just how like normal a part of wizarding society they are. But like, let's do a check-in of like house elves. Like, what do we make of house elves here? And like, what do we make of Hermione's reaction to house elves as well?
We saw how passionately she stood up for Winky at the World Cup. As a muggle-born, Hermione isn't as ingrained in this wizard norm of having house elves. Neither is Harry. But I think it stands out more for Hermione. What sticks out to me the most is the fact that I'm sure Hermione's not the only student that has never seen the elves at Hogwarts, which means not only do they do all this work and maintain the castle, but they do it undetected. Mm-hmm. They're magical, resourceful, and sneaky enough to do all this without any appearances in front of the students. And I'm sure that there are some students that have come and gone all 7 years without ever meeting a Hogwarts house elf.
Right.
I think that is interesting because the house elves are in this position as the servants or the help. But considering how magical and sneaky they are, I'm surprised there hasn't been a house elf rebellion.
Right.
I feel history of magic has mentioned numerous goblin rebellions, and yet the house elves are capable of doing all this work under wizard noses.
Right. And
we've seen how influential and impactful one independent elf can be from book two. Imagine if hundreds of elves were organized and conspiring. I think right. the wizards find themselves in a much different societal position.
That's true. And maybe that's why they're written as to like be happy with doing the work that they do. Because like with Dobby, like it's interesting because we met Dobby and we were on Dobby's side because we saw how much he suffered being with the Malfoys. And then we met Winky, who's supposed to be a better example of a house elf than Dobby is, right? But who also ended up breaking the rules, right? And going against what her master wanted and was fired for it. And so we have a whole number, an unknown number of house elves working at Hogwarts. And so maybe we might see more break the rules because the two we've met so far have done so.
Yeah. I just find it miraculous that we've gone this far into the books without ever seeing one walking down the corridors, without ever seeing one cleaning or, I mean, how many times have the kids been up in the Gryffindor common room late into the night
That's
by
true.
That fire? And yet these house elves that clean everything haven't even been spotted.
Right.
They are chameleons. We've seen how they can vanish, even though you can't apparate, as they mentioned apparition in the last book.
Mm-hmm. The other important introduction we get in these chapters is Mad-Eye Moody, who makes a grand entrance. We get a pretty detailed description of what he looks like. And we sort of learned a little bit more about him in the previous chapters, where we learned that, you know, he was a dark wizard catcher and he's like paranoid now. And there was a big incident with his dustbins. I mean, what do we make of his introduction? Like, not just like we see him, like we get a physical introduction to him in the Great Hall, but then we really like our first interaction with him is when he comes to Harry's defense. When he and Malfoy are arguing and turns Malfoy into a ferret. So it's like, all of a sudden, like, I was like blown away. I was like, you know, when you're reading this, it's like, who is this guy? Like, what do we make of him?
I'm not sure what to make of him, but I am very excited for his class because he seems like a very tough, very exciting, very dive in there and do it, and I'm going to teach you how, which I think is such a wonderful juxtaposition from like Lockhart in book two, where Moody doesn't seem to talk about all the things he did, but you can tell he's seen some stuff and he knows what's happening. And then he just takes care of business. He sees something he doesn't like and he's like, oh, this kid's gonna learn a lesson. And I love that.
I love that even though Moody is clearly not by the book.
No.
he has a deeply embedded code of honor, and Moody has a very firm idea of what he thinks proper behavior should be. And he seems easily triggered. I'm sure that perhaps seeing Malfoy attack Harry probably reminded him of several wizards that tried to get the jump on him. We know that, I mean, we kind of know from the article Malfoy shows Ron that Moody can very easily be quick to attack, or when he thinks he's being attacked, he will respond really harshly. But I think it's nice to finally see a sense of what a real dark wizard catcher or like a wizard soldier looks
right.
like. And that we don't just hear all of this appearance that he has. We actually see his appearance in the book because the illustration for chapter 13 gives us a real look at Moody, and he looks demonic, haunting. He looks more like a ghoul than a person.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it's interesting that like he like has a code of ethics, because I'm pretty sure, if I'm remembering correctly, he attacks Malfoy because Malfoy was gonna like go after Harry when Harry's back was turned, right? And so it's like he doesn't like people that sort of skirt around sort of like the etiquette of dueling or fighting or whatever. But at the same time, I think he seems like the kind of person that also is like, what, you guys have a rule about not transfiguring students when they do something wrong? Like, fuck that. You know, like, it's like he has like the moral code and then like all of the like stupid rules. He's like, no, I'm not sure I'm going to follow that.
if I may, Moody strikes me as the kind of, dare I say, teacher who did things very harsh back in the day and like was not afraid to slap the wrists of his students with a ruler. Mm-hmm. And now all these like PC pro student rules are being put in place by younger teachers. And he's like, what? No, I'm not going to coddle the kids. If they're being an idiot, I'm going to let them know that they're being an idiot. And I'm going to turn them into a ferret while I'm at it.
Yes. I'm excited to see more from him, especially because it's so interesting that like he's not just like this new Defense Against the Dark Arts teacher. It's like he has experience, but also like Arthur Weasley like went out of his way to like help him in this situation that we saw like a chapter earlier. So I think it seems like he's going to be more important than just like an average teacher. And I think most of our all of our Defense Against the Dark Arts teachers have been important to the plot in some way. So I am excited to see more from him. And also I loved at the end of the chapter when like Fred and George and Lee Jordan are like, dude, like he's the real deal.
Yeah. I think one of my favorite things about book four in general is that it really just expands the world. We see how big other wizarding countries are with the World Cup. And I think what we can expect from the Tri-Wizard Tournament with these new schools. And Moody seems to be a great door into what it's really like out there fighting the dark arts. It's not just messing with some diary in a little basement.
Right.
It's real, it's rough, it's war. So I'm excited to what Moody will teach the kids. Maybe he'll teach them the ferret spell.
I'm also really interested to know, like, what is Moody's eye made of? Is it like a glass eye that's enchanted? Is it like a dragon's eye that has been modified to work
that's
for
a good
him?
Question.
Because they talk about electric blue. And like, it's very oversized and it can see through matter. And I'm just fascinated by that. Cause if it was like a glass eye that was magical, I would feel they could make it like the size just to go in your eye socket.
Right. Right. That's such a good question, because it's like, is that something that like magical doctors can do, or is that something that like he designed himself because he needed to keep an eye on things, no pun intended, you know? That's such a good, he's so fascinating. Like, oh my, like I would just love to just like buy him a drink and just like listen to all of his stories.
You'd probably have to buy him a few to get him to loosen up.
I'm sure. Yeah.
Although he like sniffs at his food and like he drinks from his flask at the first dinner, so maybe he will be too paranoid to let you buy him a drink.
That's true. Just give him money. Here, buy your own.
Yeah.
Oh, speaking of money, there is 1,000 galleons prize money for this tournament, and I couldn't help but look up the currency from galleons to US dollars. And 1,000 galleons comes out to about $6,500 US. So I know, I don't think that's going to buy you a house if you win the tournament, but you can go on a few nice vacations if you win this tournament.
Right. That's so true. And like, especially like, we're already starting to see sort of like the weird pricing of things. Like the omnioculars that Harry buys are more expensive than buying a wand.
Yeah, that's insane.
It's just, that just doesn't seem right. Like,
but
that,
people in their sports, man, they get a fair. Little obsessive.
I'm sure they. I'm sure that price was just thrown through the roof because it's like, yeah, it's the World Cup. People will buy it.
Right. That's true. That's also very true.
You know, like a $18 beer at a baseball stadium.
Oh my God, I know.
I know. You mentioned the doctors briefly when you were talking about Moody and his eye. And it's crazy because we've seen all the bones in an arm be regrown in one night. And although we accept that, oh, there are some magical scars that last forever, Moody could have easily just thrown an eye patch over his eye, but instead he goes above and beyond to deliberately put like this eye that kind of makes him big brother.
Right.
Just staring at everybody, keeping an eye. He probably lost the eye and is like, no one is ever going to get the jump on me ever again.
Yeah.
And so I'm going to give myself a tool and turn my body into a weapon that protects
me. Transformed my body into a dangerous weapon.
Scooby-Doo.
Yes.
Oh, wow. I'm glad
you caught that.
I haven't heard that in years.
Yeah, I would not put it past Moody to sort of find every and any way to sort of keep on top of things for sure, you know?
I'm also curious what all Aurors do now that Voldemort's gone, because I feel it's been long enough to where most of his followers that were problematic have been rounded up. And they seem like they're, you know, they're the dark wizard catchers. So I feel they're not going after wizards that are just doing like minor infractions.
Right.
So I'm curious, like, as to how heavy that workload still is, how necessary they still are.
That's such a good point. And I wonder, and like, speaking of that Big Brother reference, it's like, maybe they're just sort of in place just in case. But I'm also, like, I'm sure that, like, if their workload has been light, I'm sure they all got a call the night of the Quidditch Cup after the Death Eaters made themselves known. Because it's true, it seems like everyone sort of has mostly moved past, you know, the Voldemort era, you know, but we also see, you know, in this book a few times, like sort of that trauma of that era sort of coming back to life, really. And like, where all of a sudden people are remembering like how terrifying it was. But that's such a good question as to like what they do day to day. You know, my guess would be that they try to figure out where the next threat might be coming from.
Surveillance. But,
yeah.
A paranoid person like Moody is a natural fit for that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And I'm just trying to think ahead to the previous chapters. Moody would not have been hired, I imagine, until after the Dark Mark appeared at the World Cup.
I don't think we know.
I'm curious when he got that letter from Dumbledore.
Yeah.
Was he already scheduled to come in and be a teacher, or did Dumbledore see the Dark Mark and go, oh, maybe I need a grizzled vet to
a real teacher
help protect the school. I was going to hire another Lockhart, but I give it to a capable guy this time.
But at the same time, I think he would still want Moody even before the Dark Mark, after hearing Trelawney's prophecy last year.
Oh.
Oh, yeah. That's a good point.
Because he seems to have foresight in the most important of times.
Right. And it sounds like he also trusts Trelawney as well, you know, because I think when Harry tells Dumbledore, like, oh, this weird thing happens, like, it sounds like Trelawney has had a successful prediction before of some kind. So yeah, that's also a really good point. Like, maybe it was after that he was like, okay, my really good defense against the dark arts teacher isn't coming back next year, so let me get another practical person that knows what they're doing.
And it's interesting that you mentioned Trelawney, because we do see her classroom in chapter 13, and she warns Harry that the thing you're dreading will come to pass, and like, you're right to worry. Right. Which, given her prediction at the end of last book, I'm not going to dismiss that so readily. It feels like something is afoot at Hogwarts, which, big surprise, that's happened a couple times already.
Something's always afoot at Hogwarts. And that's the thing. Like, I feel like we probably can't just dismiss Trelawney so easily now. But I did look into Harry's birth chart, and she is wrong about Saturn ruling Harry's chart. It's not perfect because we don't know. I don't know what time Harry was born, and also Godric's Hollow isn't a real place. But I found out that Venus is actually the planet that rules over Harry's chart.
Oh,
Harry is a Leo with a Pisces moon, and Saturn is in Virgo on Harry's chart. So it doesn't rule over he wasn't born under Saturn. But when I looked into the Saturn in Virgo, it says that these people can feel limited by or crushed under their work or their routine. They can feel overburdened and left to their own devices rather than feeling like they're getting help. And it also says they often have they have more on their plate than what they think is fair, which I thought actually kind of applies to Harry with everything that he has to deal with.
Yeah,
he certainly seems to have a lot on his plate for his age.
Oh my God, I know. And now we're not just dealing with like magical stuff, but Harry also has like a crush.
I know.
We're starting to get into the emotional part of teenagerhood.
Harry had a strange desire to join the Ravenclaw table.
It's so funny because it's just that line. And then it's like not referenced like ever again until Harry has like, he's like fantasizing about winning the tournament and like impressing Cho Chang. And it's like, okay, Harry.
The things we do for girls.
I feel Hogwarts would be a tough place to navigate even without all of the extra struggles of one being famous.
Yes.
For something that you really don't want to be famous for.
Right.
And then also all of the struggles of we've seen in the last three books. Because I feel the classes, the homework, the, you know, rivalries between the houses, being in a completely new world you didn't even know existed.
Mm-hmm.
You know. I would love to go to Hogwarts, but at the same time, I do not think it would be a walk in the park.
Yes, I would agree. I would probably agree with that.
I would definitely not submit my name for this tournament. I just want to sit back with a butterbeer and just watch somebody else struggle.
I'm also very curious what they have done to make the Triwizard Tournament safer. Because they talk about how so many people have died, but like this year will be fine.
We've only spent the last 3 years like harboring a murder snake and hiring werewolves and encouraging time travel and hiding
sources. And having a three-headed dog on a floor.
It's fine.
I love Fluffy.
I miss Fluffy.
I, yeah, I know. I'll be, yeah, I hope they're doing more than just restricting the age.
Yeah.
Impartial judge. Who's that going to be?
Hopefully, also, who definitely can't not Snape.
Be impartial, because I feel, you know, anyone who's judging would have gone to one of these three schools.
Right. And also, like, how, like, what does the judging consist of? Like, yeah. Is it a test? Is it a personality quiz?
Check one for yes, check two for yes. You're the champion.
Right.
We also see how excited people in the families are about the Triwizard Tournament, which brought up an interesting point for me of how do people watch sports or watch events in the Wizarding World if they're not actually physically there? Do they just read about it the next day in the Daily Prophet? People seem very into their sports still, but I feel if you're not physically there, you lose the excitement.
That is such a good question. I haven't thought about that, because like Ron's like a big Quidditch fan. Like, how does he see any of those games?
Especially because he's not well off. The Weasleys can't afford to see every Quidditch game that happens.
Right. That's such a good question. I have no idea. World,
you can check in, like, who won the hockey game today? Who won the baseball game today? It's not the same as actually sitting down at once in a while and watching it.
Right, exactly. Like, you miss all, like, the little details of, like, you know, like, how do you keep track of, like, your favorite players? Like, you know, when I watch hockey, it's like, you know, you're paying attention to like how the team is doing as a whole, and also like how individual players are doing within that team. Like, if I just listen to like, oh, the Islanders won yesterday, then it's like, okay, cool. But like, I wouldn't know that like, oh, Matt Barzal was the only one that like got his, you know, penalty shot in overtime in the net. You know, like, I wouldn't know that. Like, they might have written it down, but I wouldn't have seen it.
If I hang a poster of Victor Krum in my dormitory, we know the poster will move, but will it show like a highlight reel from Krum's latest match? Is that how you see at least snippets?
That would be a wonderful invention that you could probably charge 10 galleons for.
I mean, if it's anything like the Omnoculars, you're going to go
right. Broke. Yeah. Oh, it's such a
wand broke, but I really want the new Krum poster. I know. Decisions. I feel like there was something I could do to get 1,000 galleons.
Enter a dangerous tournament. And that's also another thing where the family, like the Weasleys are so excited about it. But like Mrs. Weasley also was like frantic thinking something happened at the Quidditch World Cup. Does she know that there was a huge death toll like for the Triwizard Tournament before?
I mean, if I'm Arthur, I've had a long day at work. I just want to come home and eat dinner. I'm going to neglect that detail. So Molly, don't worry me.
Fair point.
I think we get a lot of love for McGonagall in these chapters too.
Yeah.
I love when she interrupts the ferret bouncing, which I love how violent that is too. Like, he's just smacking him on the ground as this ferret, which I find hysterical. And then when Dumbledore is announcing the Triwizard Tournament, Fred loudly says, "You're joking!" And the whole Great Hall hears him. And he goes, "I am not joking, Mr. Weasley. Though now that you mention it, I did hear an excellent one over the summer about a troll, a hag, and a leprechaun who all go into a bar." And Professor McGonagall clears her throat loudly. And he's like, "Oh, maybe this is not the time." No.
Poor McGonagall needs to keep everything on track.
I know. I really want to know how often she has to do that. How often Dumbledore goes on these like old man rants and dad jokes, and she just has to be like, "Okay, back to what we were talking about."
Minerva McGonagall, assistant director of Hogwarts School.
Literally.
We got no time. Poor woman. Keep going, Dumble.
I guarantee you she doesn't get paid enough for what she has to go through.
Oh, I agree.
And she has such deep respect for Dumbledore, but I think she knows she could run the school more efficiently.
Oh, yeah. Yes. I mean, Dumbledore is a very accomplished, talented wizard, but like is also just a character in and of himself.
Yeah. And I think we get a lot of that in the books. And I love seeing more of McGonagall. She's been one of my favorites since the very beginning.
Mm-hmm.
And now we have Moody, and his classes are coming up. What's the next chapter called?
I think the next chapter is The Unforgivable Curses.
The Unforgivable Curses.
It's also a really tells me
that's movies class. I don't think that's Trelawney.
Well, we'll see what happens.
We will. I'm very interested to see if McGonagall and Moody have more butting heads in the future.
Definitely.
Because they seem very much opposite sides of the spectrum, whereas McGonagall is very by the book, very proper. And Moody is like, well, I'll teach them somehow. They will learn from me, just not by book.
Right.
Turn a few of them into creatures in order to do it. They will be informed.
Moody definitely seems like the kind of teacher where like the whole time you're in class, you're like, what the fuck? And then you like the school year ends and then you're like, oh yeah, I remember this, this, and this. I did learn a lot, I guess.
Yeah. I also think, I don't think they'll have as close of a relationship as Lupin, just because Lupin was so personable, but I do think he is gonna be one of the favorite teachers.
Moody seems a lot less cuddly than Lupin.
Yeah, he seems a lot less cuddly, but he seems very interactive and like he teaches in a way that's interesting.
Right.
It's not going to be like History of Magic where it's just reading a book in a monotone voice.
Right, exactly.
I can just picture Moody's first class just reading, drawing from a book. And if we conclude, ha, you're dead. You let your guard down. Now we will avoid this happening. You must always be alert. Do you want an eye like this? I didn't.
I wouldn't put it past him, honestly.
Get ready for military drills and a lot of push-ups.
There's no Quidditch this year, so the kids have to stay in shape somehow.
Yeah, and if they're willing to neglect the whole Quidditch year when it was such a big part of the last book, what on earth do they have in store to replace it with this tournament?
I know. Better be good.
Yeah. Fight the giant squid. Fight the giant squid.
You know, and I'm like, oh my God, the squid. Well, thank you guys for joining me today.
Thanks for having us on.
Do you guys have anything you want to shout out, share?
We are having a Harry Potter themed wedding in October. We are very excited for that. The tables will be themed along with Hogwarts classes and houses. So there'll be a Gryffindor, Ravenclaw, Hufflepuff, Slytherin table, and there'll be potions, defense against the dark arts, and Quidditch. And
we will have a sorting hat.
But ours does not sing.
Ours does not sing.
That's fair. And unlike Hogwarts, you guys will be promoting unity the entire time.
That is true.
Hogwarts promotes unity for a day.
I mean, we could talk about Harry Potter all day long, but we won't make anyone else listen to that.
I know, that's why us three get along so well.
Yes.
Well, thank you guys again. I'm so happy that you were able to join me for these two chapters.
They're fun ones. I love this book, and it's going to be very interesting to see how it progresses.
Mm-hmm.
Sarah gave us an option of which two chapters did we want to cover of like these next four. And we chose these two because we want to cover the introduction of Moody and the Triwizard Tournament.
Yeah.
Because they're huge parts of what's to come.
First Years is a production of Matchbook. It's produced by Quinn Parker and myself, Sarah Jones-Dittmeyer. All sources can be found in our show notes or on our website at authorsarahjonesdittmeyer.info/firstyearspodcast. That's Sarah with an H, and Dittmeyer is spelled Dittmeier. Please remember that staying a Harry Potter fan is the biggest form of revolt that you can have, and we are committed to continuing to make this fandom and this community safe and welcoming.